This morning is Patrice Sutton, and Patrice is a research scientist with the University of California, San Francisco's Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment.
Thank you so much, and also thank you all to all of you who came out this early in the morning to hear these talks. So this presentation is actually represents a shared perspective between three organizations, my own, as well as the Collaborative on Health and the Environment, which is also known as CHE. CHE is a international collaboration of people and organizations that basically are committed to advancing public discourse and science related to the relationship of environment and health, and also AARP, which is a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization that is concerned about the health of individuals age 50 and over. So the bottom line is you're going to see why is the Department of Obstetrics and AARP in the same presentation. I have no conflicts of interest. So our program at UCSF is, our mission is to advance reproductive and developmental health by preventing harmful environmental exposures. And I would just note that the environmental drivers of human health are increasingly recognized in the clinical field by virtue of the fact that our program is in the School of Medicine at UCSF. The Collaborative on Health and the Environment has many relevant publications to this issue, and I just want to point out that there's these brochures about healthy aging and the environment in the back and in the front, and you can take, given that there's not a scarcity issue here, as many as you would like, and I encourage you please to take them. And I just want to also kind of acknowledge that it's their work really that are drawing these connections. In terms of AARP's perspective, their slogan is what we do for all. And I guess the thing that all three groups that are participating in this morning's presentation really share is the idea that the road to healthy aging is paved through healthy pregnancies, healthy children, and healthy adults. So there's a lot of environmental influences across the lifespan, and I'm going to talk about each of them in a little more detail. But the thing I want to point out here is that these factors interact with one another to create either good health or to actually to the detriment of our health. And moreover, these environmental influences are working on towards good or poor health throughout the lifespan. In terms of an ecological health framework, really all we're talking about there is the context that individual health is nested in our relationships, our families, our communities, our society, and our ecosystem. So if we're turning our attention to healthy aging, we have to really look at all of these different domains because they're going to affect our health, and we can't take an individual's health outside of these contexts because the environment works on all of these different levels. So I'm just going to quickly run through some of these environmental factors. In terms of the social environment, the WHO 2008 panel on social determinants of health literally said that the social injustice is a matter of life and death. How, whether our communities are walkable, whether there's food that's healthy and accessible readily also affects our health. In terms of environmental chemicals, since the end of World War II, there's been a dramatic increase in the amount of chemicals that are used in commerce, such that now there's tens of thousands of chemicals in commerce. 3,000 chemicals are used in high volumes, like more than 1 million pounds a year, and more than 700 new chemicals are introduced into our society every year. So the effect of this is that basically exposure to environmental chemicals is ubiquitous, and we are exposed every day, literally every body, because these chemicals have been measured in our population, and I'll talk more about that too. But the bottom line in terms of human health is possibly best conceptualized by the 2009 report, or rather, sorry, last year, 2010 report by the President's cancer panel of reducing environmental cancer risk. And when they looked at this issue of the relationship between environment and cancer, one of their conclusions were, to a disturbing extent, our babies are born pre-polluted. Nutrition, the nutritional environment is another aspect of environmental health and drivers of healthy aging. So it's not just what this child eats, but how it is grown that will affect not only the child's health, but the adult that that child will become. So our industrialized food system has been quite effective in producing food that's at relatively low price, but most of the people here at APHA, I'm sure, are well aware that the food that we deliver through our industrialized food system is not of necessarily good nutritional quality, and that there are real costs in terms of chronic health impacts that relate to our industrialized food system. The food system that we have to grow all this relatively cheap food that is not of very high nutritional quality also involves heavy use of antimicrobials as growth promoters and to help keep animals healthy when they're actually raised in extremely unhealthy environments. So 70% of the antimicrobials that are used in the U.S. today are used in non-therapeutic doses in animal food production. And this has been well recognized to be a major contributor to the antibiotic resistance among human pathogens. Pesticides are applied in the quantities of millions of pounds every year to produce our food. And there's also chemicals that enter our food system and our nutritional environment through canned food. We have bisphenol A in canned foods. You have your phthalates and the plastic wrap that you're going to put over your food. And then you have perfluorinated chemicals that are in those pizza boxes to give them grease and water resistance and in nonstick fry pans. And a lot of us are relying on NHANES data this morning. This is data from the National Health and Examination and Nutrition Survey, which shows that these food system-related chemicals actually show up in pregnant women. And I'll explain why we're particularly concerned about pregnant women in a moment. But you can see, first of all, if you look at all of the colors and you look at the bottom axis and you can see 80%, all of these chemicals are present on average in over 80% of the population. And if you take it from the top, that's bisphenol A in blue. Next are your phthalates that I talked about. The red ones, or the pink ones, I guess, are your organophosphorus pesticides. The green ones are your organochlorine pesticides, which, of course, is interesting because these pesticides have been banned many years ago, and they're showing up in pregnant women today. Then you get the light green, which are your perfluorinated compounds, which I mentioned before in terms of pizza boxes and nonstick fry pans. And then the red ones are PCBs, also banned many, many years ago, which just really speaks to environmental health policy in general and the need to realize that the decisions we make today will be visited on future generations. And then there's also mercury. And the thing about the red and the orange and mercury is, if you notice that, number one, that there is such widespread exposure, but also you wouldn't necessarily think of these chemicals as germane to the food and nutritional environment because they enter through other activities. But so just to keep in mind also that when we're thinking about healthy aging and the environment and chemical exposures, we have to be aware that when we make decisions, literally those decisions come back to us in our food supply. So not everybody is equally vulnerable to environmental exposures. And this graph is from the 2009 Science and Decisions from the National Academy of Sciences, which was actually looking at how we assess risk to environmental exposures. But for the purpose of this presentation, what I wanted to point out is that if you look at the first, I guess, is there a pointer? Maybe not. Oh, I know how that works. If you look at this graph, pretty technology proficient here, hey? If you look at this first distribution, there's a situation where basically you have a healthy population with no background exposures. Actually, I think that's possibly a theoretical distribution because I don't know who doesn't have background exposures if you look at the previous slide. But in any event, you could say, okay, we'll have an environmental exposure, there'd be no adverse effect. But what's relevant particularly to the issue of aging is that if you look at the next line, next distribution, there's someone who's healthy but has no, with some background exposure. And then if you look at the dark line here, that's a more vulnerable population with background exposure. And you can see that you get increasing numbers of the population seeing an adverse effect when you have both a background exposure and a vulnerability that could be related in this case to age or underlying disease status. So older populations as well as younger populations or people who have these other exposures or diseases are not, these exposures are not equally relevant. They're more relevant to other populations. And one of the reasons is because, indeed, the timing of exposure matters. As indicated by this cover of Time magazine, this might be a, well, it's not really an overstatement, but it's not necessarily deterministic. I guess that's the difference I would have it with it. But it is about how the first 9 months shape the rest of your life, and I'll try to explain why that is. So we now know that there are critical and sensitive windows of development, and when you have an environmental exposure during these windows, it in fact can have a permanent effect, which is what the Time magazine is alluding to. It can drive your health throughout the life course. And first of all, I just want to say that development is not just in utero, but it continues postnatally. So young, so infants and young children and even adolescents are more susceptible to environmental exposures. Now, this this idea is really the basis of the developmental origins of adult health and disease. Bear with me for a second. In the mid-80s, there was a an epidemiologist, David Barker, who did a study which had paradoxical findings. And the findings were that people who had low birth weight and undernutrition in utero, when Dr. Barker looked at their health later in life, he found an increase in cardiovascular disease and diseases essentially of the rich. So why, one asked, would if you had a poor or undernutritional environment in utero, do you end up with diseases of the rich? And this is just one example I'm going to give as to kind of the research that was subsequently gathered to try to explore what was known as the Barker hypothesis. And to do that, you have to go back to Nazi Germany during World War II. And they looked at folks who, there was a famine. It was called the hunger winter. There was a discrete period of time of severe undernutrition that they were able to look back and see what the children who were in utero at that time, what were the outcomes 50 years later for these children? Now, as you might, of course, expect, there were adverse consequences of undernutrition. But what was particularly interesting was that there was a specific effect depending on when in the pregnancy the fetus was exposed to famine. So early in gestation, there was a threefold increase in coronary heart disease and more obesity. If you were exposed to famine mid-gestation, there were increases in obstructive airway diseases, and late in gestation, impaired glucose tolerance. And as you all know, that these are really key drivers of not only chronic diseases, but also very costly diseases. So there's a wide body of data like this. This is just exemplary of this in terms of the developmental origins of adult health in the nutritional field. In the field of environmental health, we have kind of the proof of concept of the same idea comes from the evidence around diethylstilbestrol, which was a drug that was given to pregnant women to actually prevent miscarriage. And in the 1970s, the early 1970s, it was discovered, in fact, that although the drug had no adverse effects on the pregnant woman, years, decades later, the children of the mothers who took DES showed up with a wide range of adverse reproductive health effects, including a rare cancer. And in fact, this endocrine disruptor would likely not have been even identified except for the fact that there was an astute clinician who recognized that he should not be seeing so many cases of clear cell adenocarcinoma, clear cell carcinoma of the vagina, when you should see either zero or one case in your whole career. But because he was at a referral center, this was discovered. And I bring that up just to say that we are, as you could see from the previous slide, exposing pregnant women and our whole society to a wide range of endocrine-disrupting chemicals now that'll be very difficult to identify what the effects really will be long-term. So beyond DES, and kind of this is really getting to a statement by the Endocrine Society related to this, now the Endocrine Society in 2010 had a whole statement and position paper which basically looked at the evidence and concluded that there's evidence for adverse reproductive health outcomes, including infertility, cancers, from exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals, and there's other mounting evidence for other adverse effects. So what can be done? So I kind of have tried to summarize very quickly this idea that the environment is affecting health over the lifetime. But as I started to say, the shared perspective of the groups that are involved with this work is that we really need to have healthy pregnancies, children, and adults. So this is a book, and I have to say I did love the fact that it's about healthy aging, and it's a large print edition, which I always appreciate large fonts these days. And this book really lays out that much of the chronic diseases of aging are indeed preventable. The costs are preventable. We could put those costs to better use, the costs of providing health care for these chronic diseases to much better use. And it talks about basically healthy lifestyles and how healthy lifestyles can contribute to healthy aging. And that is indeed true. And this data, I'm sure most of the people in the room are familiar with, the idea that you can increase your risk for chronic disease by not eating fruits and vegetables and not paying attention to your omega-6s and or 3s and that type of thing. And we all probably know what we're supposed to eat at this point, which is a Mediterranean diet, which I approve of because it does involve red wine. So. And in terms of toxic chemicals, there's actually empirical evidence, and this is a study from Washington State where they took 23 children and they fed them a conventional diet and then they fed them an organic diet. And you can see on the top graph that when you are on the organic diet and you're a child, this was the urinary metabolites of malathion and I'm just blocked on the second pesticide, but these are urinary metabolites basically that they're measuring. And you can see when the kids are on the organic diet, they really don't have the pesticide metabolites in their blood, indicating that yes, if you eat organic food, you can reduce your exposure to pesticides. Okay. So, and there's another study that if you go to eating healthy food, you can get rid of those bisphenol A and phthalates. So it is true that individual action is important, but we actually really need policy to create the opportunities for individuals to make healthy choices. And so when you go to the store, by default, you're going to have the option of actually choosing what you need to do. There's also, I would just mention, the idea of environmental justice, because many exposures are not avoidable by individual actions, air pollution, water pollution, etc. This is just showing that issues such as the social justice issues that I started the talk with are not amenable to individual action. And today in Oakland, where I live and work, children are going to school hungry. Similarly, workers and agricultural communities are disproportionately exposed to pesticides. That's not amenable to individual action. These are just slides from different communities that are affected. So we need policy action for healthy aging, and I just am going to close with some suggested avenues. They're not complete by any means, but just conceptually that by acting upstream on policy to reduce chemical exposures in this case, this is just to indicate that we do not have a functional chemical policy, which many of you in this country, in this room, are well aware of. So we go after one chemical at a time. We need comprehensive policy to reform the Toxic Substance Control Act. Right now, if you look at a drug, it's not necessarily as good a system as we would hope for, but basically all of our chemicals in the environment are put into the environment without testing for the most part. So we don't really know. This is just to indicate that if you're worried about how much fish you should eat, you also need to be worried about how much mercury is getting into the air from coal-fired power plants, because that's why there's mercury in fish in the U.S. today. This is just to indicate, as I'm running out of time, that policy matters. Blood lead levels dropped when we did take lead out of gasoline. This is just to indicate workplace health is really a critical area of intervention because basically in terms of chronic health disease, most regulated chemicals in the workplace don't even look at chronic health disease, and the idea that safer alternatives in the workplace will lead to healthier outcomes later in life. And this is just a paper to self-promote that we are looking at why the food system is an important point of policy intervention. So this is just an example to close with the idea that policy is needed, right? And this looks kind of old-fashioned, but the truth is that last year, food companies spent over $4 billion to market fast food to basically your patients and all the communities that you care about, and there's policy that's needed to actually shift the balance in the favor of people making good health choices. And this is just actually at an APHA in Pennsylvania, I found in a cookbook this at the beginning, and I really liked it, that a society grows when old men plant trees, the shade of which they will never sit. We have to kind of worry about what we're leaving. Thank you.